All right, well, let's get started. You're the guinea pigs, so I have a second session after this, which may turn out to be two different sessions. I don't know. My name's Dan Seidel. I'm the art guy. I'm the one dressed in black. I can to talk about modern art, I have to wear black. It's my uniform. I am an art critic that works at Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church in Fort Lauderdale. So my other uniform is sandals. So when I came here, I had to find socks and shoes and big boy clothes, I guess. I want to give you a perspective on modern art that can open space for you to think about it and experience it in a way perhaps that is different than you have been trained, or that you have that you feel the need to respond in one way or another. And for the most part, when we're talking about modern art, and I'm using Edvard Munch and his painting The Scream as an opportunity and as an occasion, an example to think about modern art, really the problem is abstract painting. What are we to make of it? And I worked for 11 years as a chief curator at a university art museum, and I saw the looks on people's faces coming in. I want to like it. I want to. And either there was no guidance, or the guidance was stuffy and elitist, and I feel that you would need to have headphones on and have somebody with a British accent describe to you all of the things that you don't have access to. And so what I want to try to do is to break down some of those barriers for you. And also, this is part of what I'm presenting to you now is part of my rethinking in some ways, and deepening my thinking of modern art that has occurred since my change in vocation. So one of the things I want to emphasize with modern art is about brokenness. It's about failure. It's about the recognition that the world is not as it should be. And in that context, modern art is a lament. We may not, and particularly those of us who are Christians, are not trained to think about it that way. We're trained to think about it as this is a product of a nihilistic worldview, humanist worldview. They're arrogant. They're thumbing their noses at us. Get us some art that we recognize. But I'd like to present to you another approach and another way to think about modern art, one that emphasizes the fact that these artists, many of these artists, are in the cave, have burrowed into the rabbit hole of their fallenness, and they recognize it. And they understand it. And the paintings themselves are means by which they are working through it. I feel, and I've felt it more strongly, that what needs to be done is not to have more education about art, but in fact for me at this moment, kill your and to destroy what you already know about art. That what we need to do is to start over again, which has been the process of my teaching. I spent a number of years as a college teacher, and what I presumed was that, and the ideal context, the ideal student for me was someone who didn't know anything about it. The hardest students for me were those students that were entering their last year. They had taken a bunch of classes. They had an idea of what art was. And it was a difficult opportunity, it was a difficult situation for me to try to find ways for them to unlearn it. Why do I say unlearn it? Unlearn it because the textbook approach to the history of art leaves out certain existential, real human anxieties and human felt issues that artists deal with. And I had access to that because for over 12 years I worked very closely with an artist who had a studio in LA and a studio in Miami. An artist who had dealers throughout the world, had collectors throughout the world, collectors like Ridley Scott, the movie director who did Gladiator and who? What else?
Alien
did the Blade Runner, the classic Blade Runner. And Ridley Scott would talk to his friends, Hollywood friends, about what a genius this artist was that I was working with. And I got to see on the inside how he worked. So much of how I taught in my classes, how I worked as a curator, and what I'll present to you, comes out of my daily working, my experience with him. And what I also saw there was tremendous anxiety and the rabbit hole that he was in as an artist. And I want to present that to you. So also one of the things I want to have on the table is that I'm working at Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church because God killed my career as an art historian and as a museum curator. I thought my understanding was that God was training and providing this opportunity for me to move my family, three teenage kids from Nebraska with all of my family around, to Miami to direct the studio of this artist that I'll talk briefly about. I thought God was preparing me for this opportunity. He was an artist who was an atheist, had created this interesting space for us to have interaction with from my Christian faith and his atheism. It seemed though even as atheists and Christian, we were back to back bumping up against things that were similar, that we were doing battle the world in a similar way. So I had assumed that everything was being planned out for this wonderful opportunity for this Christian to go and be a witness to this atheist artist. And it fell apart. And I was left desperately scrambling out of the rabbit hole, either having to choose to leave the studio or to risk the destruction of my family. So I left the studio. As my career as an art historian, as a museum curator, and as a person in the art world, interacting with people like Ridley Scott, interacting with the collectors and dealers and museum curators around the world, what God was doing in that process was putting me in contact with other people. So those other people, Talian Chavijan, who's the senior pastor at Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church, and Jonathan Lindahl, who some of you know. He teaches New Testament at Knox Seminary. Those two men saved my life. And I'm here today to be able to talk to you about this work because those two have saved my life. So let's move on. Modern art is a buzzkill, absolute buzzkill. Because it deals with death, it deals with brokenness, and it deals with the inability of art to represent a world that is fulfilled, culminated, consummated. I'm going to show you a couple examples of the painter that I worked very closely with, Enrique Martinez Celaya. This is a painting called Crying Girl. Many of the things that we'll be talking about today in our session come out of my conversations with him while he's painting. And so even before I joined his studio last summer, the summer before this past summer, he and I had worked together for about 12 years. I would fly to his studio in LA, or I would fly down to his studio in Miami, and we would work together on various projects. So I had access to his painting process, how he thought about work, how he thought about painting. This is another painting. This is a painting that's in Ridley Scott's collection. It's a painting that has an adolescent boy in front of sea grape tree by the ocean. Painting in general, and modern painting in particular, is about death. It confronts death openly and honestly. But we have to fight the perceptions of what art should be. And what art should be is painting like Thomas Kinkade that we're so familiar with. And what I want to talk about, the tradition out of which Kinkade paints, and Kinkade has utilized as a way to continue to give us the narcotic of everything's okay. Peace, peace, when there isn't peace. I wrote a blog post several months ago on Thomas Kincaid, wanting to give a sense, a theological and artistic sense, to why I felt so uncomfortable with Kincaid. And what happened, the response to that blog post was tremendous bile directed to me. That I was offending art, but I was also offending Christianity. And the sense was that we like our Christianity like we like our art. Comfortable. Makes us feel good. And I want to be able to uncouple them and to bring them together so that modern art is a way for us to think about. The development of modern art is a way for us to think about suffering in a particular way. There is something about painting itself that I also think is important for us to consider. Both the tradition of modern art and the tradition of icon painting in the church, in Eastern Orthodox Church, presuppose that something happens in painting. Spreading smelly pigments on a wood board or on rough, raw canvas material does something. It opens a space. It's something that sculpture doesn't quite do in the same way, and that other visual art forms don't do in the same way. But there's something that happens in painting. And I want to be able to reflect on that. I want to be able to reflect on that today. There is also a tremendous sense of faith that a painter has. And perhaps even faith may not be the better word. It may be hope. That you smear smelly pigments on this canvas and something happens that's important and that it's worth doing. So we have Thomas Kincaid, who wants to paint paintings of what it would be or what it was like before the fall, in which case before the fall means just a rustic getaway. Can we just be alone? So I can just be alone and then I won't sin and everything will be all, that'll be just fine. It's kind of a weekend away. And Bob Ross, whom I have a very soft spot, paints happy trees. Really happy trees. I envision him smoking a lot of pot. And carving out those trees. I mean, he makes them. And you look at the scene and you say, well, that's the way it is. That's when I see that scene, that's the way it is. But that's not the way it is. When you happen upon a scene like that, you're thinking about your mother going into a nursing home. You're thinking about your child who is suffering from lymphoma. You're thinking about all of the things that you bring in of your life, the suffering that you have, that you see that mountain and that body of water and those happy trees. We don't confront them outside of the suffering that we experience. And so one of the things that painting does, painting knocks us from the past and the future into the present. It confronts you in the present. We as fallen human beings are distracted creatures, right? We're projecting into the future. We're thinking about, I'll be happy when, I'll be happy when, I'll be happy when. Or regretting what's happened in the past. Regretting what happened yesterday, 10 years ago, trying to work through that. A painting comes to us. And what I want to emphasize and bring to you today is that the painting does more looking at us than we to them. The painting is doing something to us. And that what we need to be able to do is to hear it. The painter I worked with, Enrique Martinez Celaya, said something very interesting to me a number of years ago, and I think about it daily, and it's been something that is forming the foundation of my work. He said, we are often distracted by what paintings look like. Think about that. A painter, an artist, a visual artist, in which what we want, particularly in the contemporary church, is to revitalize the visual. But for here's a painter for whom his vision is primary, saying there's more to a painting than what you see. What does he mean by that? And I thought about it over and over and continued to think about it. And I think he's right. And I think his observation, his insight, is Lutheran. Luther said that the only organs of a Christian are the ears. So how do we affirm and focus upon painting, for example, an intensely visual practice? By affirming Luther's insight and Luther's admonition that the only organs of a Christian are the ears. And I want to take you to Mark 7. It's a miracle Jesus performed on a deaf and mute man. He takes that man amongst the group and he takes him aside. And he spits in his mouth and sticks his fingers in his ears. And when he sticks his fingers in his ears, the whole world opens to him. The Gospels say he can hear and his tongue is loosened. And Luther goes on to say the creation begins to speak and he can hear it. We hear God's promises. And we heard from Matt today. We look at the world, and the world goes against that. Right? Things are getting worse. There's suffering. We see the pain. And we reconcile that with the promise that we hear. Lo, I will be with you always. I will wipe every tear from your eye. How do we reconcile what we hear and what we see? Of a Lutheran insight is that what we're hearing unlocks and allows us to see and allows us to embrace what we see as a contradiction to what we're hearing. And what I want to suggest is that what we need to do, what we can do when we are confronted by an alienating work of art, is to begin to listen to it. But what I need to do is I need to go back and rework with you something in particular about the Western pictorial tradition, about painting, the history and development of painting. This is a painting by Jacques-Louis David. It's The Death of Socrates. Painting, in this context, is about virtuous behavior, actions that we emulate. Here is Socrates bravely taking the hemlock. It's not insignificant that it looks Eucharistic, that he is Christ amongst his followers. What is important to know is that everybody knows the story. The viewers know the story. They know the text. And the presupposition is what David is doing, is giving us, what David is doing is giving us actions to emulate. And the Western painting is very good at that. Or, for example, the French painter Ang, David's contemporary. This is a painting of Napoleon. Strength, power. And a painting painted in 1863 by the salon painter Alexander Cavanaugh, The Birth of Venus, which is beauty. You have beautiful, you have powerful, you have virtuous, heroic actions by great people. That is the register within which modern art developed. In which case the emphasis is not beauty, virtuous behavior to emulate heroes that act in ways that we can only hope we could act one day, that broken us. Failure. But there is another tradition of painting, Eastern Orthodox tradition of icon painting, and I just give you an example. This is the icon of the resurrection. This is Christ bringing trained captives, Moses, the prophets, Moses, and those that were in Hades awaiting the resurrection. Christ is doing it, bringing them. Did that event happen? Yes, the event happened, but this is a painting of a spiritual truth, a dogmatic truth, something that we don't see. It's a spiritual reality. And the emphasis in the Eastern Orthodox tradition is to emphasize a discontinuity from what you see. This is another world. This is a world transformed. And so the training for the Eastern Orthodox with icons is to understand the world as you see it as a world that is being transformed into something else. And I bring this to you, this is important, because the style of painting is very different. The style of painting is, as I mentioned, to stress this discontinuity. This is a painting that would be touched, kissed, produced, made in a liturgical context. And this is very important to keep in mind. The recognition is it's always a piece of wood. It's a piece of wood, okay? And something happens in the West. Something happens with Giotto. This is a fresco painting called The Lamentation of Christ. And you could say it all begins with a hand on the back of the neck. You see the lamentation, you see this figure. The figure is expressing grief. And what is that hand doing? That crazy hand that seems to be just sitting on the back. What is it? Given the composition, we don't really read it as a hand on the neck. We read it as the figure doing this. Now we're reading into depth. And now at this early point in the development of the Renaissance, you have painting, it opens up space. And what we begin to see then is space becomes important in this tradition of painting. Now the effect is the viewer is there. The viewer is seen. The viewer is continuous with the action that is taking place. It's emphasized by the fact that Giotto has this figure whose back is turned to us, forcing us in. So now you have a flat surface that now we're going in. And painting is this flickering or this tension between the flat surface and its referent, what it's doing to us. Whether going in or the association those images have for us. The apex of the Renaissance tradition would be Raphael. And so this is the School of Athens. Raphael paints a commission. The Pope wants four lunettes, fresco lunettes in his library. This one is the School of Athens. This is Plato and Aristotle. This is Greek philosophy. This is the knowledge of the ancients. That was in the process of being transformed and Christianized. What makes the Renaissance dynamic is that it's taking the Judeo-Christian tradition and the classical pagan tradition and putting them together, making them exist side by side, putting them in mutual illumination within the context of the church. Raphael has done something unbelievably amazing. But we often lose sight of it because this is just how we think painting is supposed to be. Raphael has taken smelly pigments, smearing them on a wet surface on the wall, and created empty space. Isn't that remarkable, that is? So we read this figure, and this figure is separated by empty space. That's not the way it is. Raphael is taking paint, the same smelly material stuff, that he smears here is the same stuff that he smears here and the same stuff that he smears here. But miraculously, mysteriously, remarkably, we have space that's now opened up. And now, hundreds of years later, we can't help but look at a painting and not go into it that way. Raphael achieved the space. He opens it up. And now, the viewer has a place to stand in which the viewer is looking at a painting and the painting's world opens up. And the architecture is continuous with the architecture in the space. So now painting is continuous with our experience of the world. Not discontinuous, as it is the icon. So the viewer now has a stable foundational place within which to stand, in which that painting opens itself, discloses itself as a world, within which optically we go in. You can go in, and there's space. But the painting, particularly a painting like this, I would suggest is an abuse of that. It took those insights and made it an avenue or a venue or a means for self-porn. Right? This is a woman who is allowing herself to be gazed at. Under the auspices of, this is Venus, but there's a mythological context, that the space opens itself, declares itself to us too easily. And modern art emerges in response to that. And the response is very interesting. And in many ways, what ends up happening is that what modern artists are going to do is to shrink that space and kill that tradition. They presuppose that tradition, but they're killing it. I show you this as a transitional work. This is a predella without an altarpiece by Hans Holbein. Dostoevsky was fascinated by this. He was fascinated by it. A predella is an architectural component to an altarpiece that is at the bottom of an altarpiece that opens up. It gives you the crucifixion. What it gives you Easter weekend. The altarpiece gives you Holy Saturday. It's when Christ sleeps. He's dead in the tomb. The altarpiece gives you the crucifixion, and then it opens to the resurrection. This is a predella with no altarpiece. And Dostoevsky was fascinated by it, and in his novel The Idiot, Prince Myshkin sees a reproduction of that image on Rogozin's wall in his apartment. And as he's looking at it, he says, a person could lose their faith by looking at this. But what I would like to do for the rest of my talk is to sit here in Holy Saturday and look at it and contemplate death and the significance of death in the context of painting. And I hope it's not a buzzkill. I hope what it does is it offers you an opportunity to be able to think and experience an inexplicable breeze of grace that blows through these works if we acknowledge the death that it deals with and the weakness that it engages. So one example, before I get to our friend Edvard, is Henri Matisse, Bathers with a Turtle, which was painted in 1908. This is a remarkable painting for a number of reasons. And what I'd like to emphasize is that these are three bathers for which there is not a bit of erotic attraction. The history of the female nude up to this point emphasizes the erotic aspect of the female body under all kinds of other guises. This is Venus, these are the graces. She's there, but she's really not there. It's inspiration. Matisse has created a composition in which these three women exist not as sexual erotic attractors. Something else is going on. They're engaged in a context in which you don't quite know how this woman is doing what she's doing, right? Where is she sitting? How is she in this painting? We're trained to see it, and Matisse expects that we understand this Western tradition. You place a figure, and you have a background. Boom, it's foreground, background, there's space that opens up. And Matisse is pushing it. He's reducing that space. And so even though we're not quite sure how she sits, we kind of buy it. The painting itself is funky and awkward enough for that not to be a big deal. There are a lot of other bigger deals, right, to deal with. One is the fact that these women really are not painted in a graceful way. They look chunky. They look like he's right-handed and he painted them with his left hand. Or he looked at what happens often, the question that comes up, well, can a child do that? And the answer is, yeah, that's the point. from Matisse and many artists in the modern tradition, the child's perspective of the world was desired. For a child draws and is drawn to the mystery of the world, the mystery of creation, the mystery of relationships, and had not learned how to make sense of them. Making sense of them meaning putting every figure where it's supposed to be and what a figure should look like. So everything is new. For the child, also the child doesn't have skill in drawing, and so the child is emphasizing his or her weakness. Picasso once said, "I've spent my entire career as an artist unlearning what I learned as a young boy." So this idea of stripping this away, not becoming an expert at their own work, and to be able to see the world as a place that is rich and enchanted, was Matisse's desire. It is not insignificant that one of Matisse's most important patrons was a Russian icon collector, who may very well have noticed certain kinds of connections. But this is a reality that's a different kind of reality. We may want to go out and swim to that nude Venus that's there being born on the foam of Poseidon, but we really don't have any inclination to go in and interact with these women. We'll leave them to their own devices. And what are their devices? They're looking at a turtle. A turtle that had the kinds of implications of it because of its patience, because of its looks very old. You know, the faces, the heads of turtles look elderly. They look like they're an old soul. They move slowly. People don't notice them. These three women are locked in observation. What is going on? Something special, enchanted, is going on. But we don't know. And for modern art, at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, painting is a means of discovering something about the world rather than expression of what is already known. When David paints the death of Socrates, everybody knows the story. Question is now, how can you present it in a way that gets people thinking later, or to get people to experience it in a fresh way? But everybody knows. Everybody knows that Birth of Venus is what it is. But nobody knows what's going on here. The other thing that's important is, as Matisse is pushing that background forward, it's not that far for a painter like Mark Rothko, who will do away with the figure as a whole and say, can a painting capture the attention of a viewer without figures, without even a narrative, without even an occasion in which for us to think about these bathers? Can color on a flat surface do that, open up that space? You probably didn't know that Monet's paintings of haystacks are about death. You may have seen them on Hallmark cards or posters in college dorm rooms, and that they are kind of they're soft and nice and pretty, but they're about death. Monet painted dozens and dozens of these haystacks during this period, at different times of the year, at different times of the day. So Monet would go out into this farmland and paint. His desire was to capture light. But what happens if you go out and try to capture light? It keeps changing on you. The tradition, the academic tradition of painting, is that you would go make those sketches and you would go back into your studio and you would build a painting that gave the essence of the haystack, the haystackness. With light always at high noon, the tradition in academic painting was to make paintings in which the light was always high noon. So you didn't have long shadows. There was a timelessness attached to it. The tradition in academic painting was also that you didn't show evidence of your hand in the paintbrush. You wanted to create an image that looked like it just came forth with no effort. No effort on the part of the painter making it. But Monet is doing everything. He's giving you everything. He's showing you the paint strokes. And his subject is changing right under him. So then he has to paint another one. And then he has to paint another one. And then he has to paint another one. And so these paintings exist as testimonies of his inability to actually paint a haystack. So let's get to our friend's screen. Painted in 1895. And you all know the image. You've seen it on coffee mugs. You've seen it on t-shirts. It's going to be on display, on view in New York. The Museum of Modern Art is going to show it. The version that was Munch painted, four versions, and the fourth version, or the one that came up for auction at Sotheby's in May, is going to be on view in New York. And I should say, and I should have mentioned at the very beginning, one of the things that we're doing here is an exercise in weakness and futility. Right? That's an awful image. That's not the painting. It's a terrible image. It's all reproduction. We have no sense of size and scale. So we're operating already in a context of failure and weakness. But this painting is seen as an icon of modernity, of desperateness, of the destruction, of the failure of modern culture. And I think they're right. Have you ever had an experience in which you've gone to, you've had a painting you wanted to look at, and you've gone to a museum, and it has underwhelmed you? You've gone to the Louvre to see
the Mona Lisa.
Leonardo's Mona Lisa. It is an unbelievable letdown. In part because you can't get to it, because it's covered up, and then there are all these people about it. But doesn't it look, if you think about it, if you saw it, doesn't it look weak and frail? You wanted it to explode, and you wanted to drop to your knees, but you don't. Look at this poor painting. I'll talk to you about Munch's life that was, from start to finish, ridden with suffering. His mother died at a very young age. His favorite sister, older sister whom he looked up to, died of an illness. She left her bed and went to a chair to sit down and died on that chair. And he took that chair and had it with him his entire life. He himself was ridden with illness and sickness, and several times was on his deathbed, spent many, many months on bedridden. His goal in the paintings that he produces was to paint a diary of his life. And one of those paintings went on auction and was sold for $120 million. But look at it. How weak and desperate it is. Munch's paintings come from pain. Art comes from joy and pain, he said, but mostly from pain. Isn't that how our life goes as well? That we refuse to acknowledge that? It comes from pain. Here's a picture of Munch. One of the things that Munch had that he loved was the fact that he was a beautiful man. He was ill and sick. He lost so many loved ones. But he was very attractive to women. And as his attractiveness waned as he got older, he openly and honestly dealt with that in his paintings. And I will show you some examples. So here he is painting on the beach. All of his masculine virility. One of the things he wanted to do in his paintings was to toughen them up. So he often painted outside. When he moved from Berlin to back home to Norway, he did so after he spent a number of months in a sanitarium. He moved back and opened up an outdoor studio where he would paint in the snow. He would subject his paintings to freezing rain and snow and bird poop and all kinds of things that were outside, much to the horror of his collectors. He thought that what he wanted to give was a patina. He wanted to give them a patina of life and experience. Subject them to nature. Put them out there in nature. Munch, as many modern artists had, had a fascination with nature, a fear and fascination. For Munch, nature was truly red in tooth and claw. It was terrifying. And he dwelt in this terror. Here's an example, Self-Portrait in Hell, painted in 1903. Knowing now what we know about Western painting, in fact, the tradition, the invention of Western painting is to open up space, what do you see here with Munch? He's closing that space. He's closing that space and he's forcing that background up to us. And that creates in us a tightness. When Jesus puts spittle on his fingers and opens up, sticks them in the ear of that deaf man recreating him, Jesus utters something. He sighs and says, "Be opened." Luther reflects on that sign, and that sign is that place in which Jesus enters into and has entered into the tightness and narrowness of creation, of sin. Saturated creation that is tight and confining. And that sigh is that sigh, that pressure that he feels. The reduction of that space is that pressure as well. That pressure that we feel in the painting that pushes out. Munch, however, was adamant and open with the fact that the world was silent to him. That scream, he talked about it as a silent scream. It came from an experience that he had in which he was walking on a bridge, and all of a sudden nature began to scream, but he couldn't hear it. He could feel it. This is a painting that he painted earlier in his career, called Puberty, which is not exactly the kind of subject that artists in the Western academic tradition were painting. They preferred their women fully developed. So for an artist at the height of his virility to be painting this young girl in this kind of situation, in which the assumption was that painters, artists were sleeping with their models, most often because they were prostitutes that they would pay to model. This creates a lot of discomfort for us. But the discomfort has as much to do with the vulnerability of the artist, who struggled continually with his own identification as a human being with strength and power. We never married, never had children. And the vulnerability of this subject, of this woman in the midst of this girl becoming a woman. The artist I work with, Enrique Martinez Celaya, all of his figures, male and female, were adolescents. It was intentional because they're not quite adults. There's an innocence and it's moving into adulthood. There's an awkwardness in that moment. And Munch is giving us that moment, and he is also implicated in it. She's looking at him with fear. And the question is, what is that on the back in the background? What is that shadow that seems to have its own substance? We also have a shadow here. This was painted much later in his life. Munch lost things that he loved. He lost his family members. He lost his good looks, his beauty. He lost his virility. And he began to lose his eyesight. So for a painter to lose his eyesight, it's a very difficult thing. And he had an eye disease. And what he is doing in this context is painting through the disease. He's actually showing us the disease. What does it look like to look at the world through this disease in which part of his vision is blocked? And as you can see, if you know mood, it is in his room. It's barely viewed, barely seen, past the physical painted embodiment of his weakness. Munch was terrified of the night, and he painted paintings called Watchmen. He lived in this big home in Eckley, and he would paint paintings serve of people he admired in his life, and they would serve as watchmen for him. And he kept lights on in his room, in the house, and he would pace. He would pace through the house because he couldn't sleep. And so he paints himself wandering. Paints himself unable to sleep. This is a far cry from Aang's Napoleon painting, or David's Death of Socrates. This is a painter for whom his painting is revealing to you his weakness. And yet at times during his career there was a painting like this, the sun, in which light bursts forth in a gigantic mural of pure light that overwhelms the darkness. And so the question, my talk focused upon grace, included grace and pilot. So where do we find grace in all of this? Can we point to a place on a painting and say, this is where grace is? This is what grace is. Where do we find hope in a painting? Let me suggest to you that it's not what we see, but again, it's what we hear. And suggest perhaps also that what we're hearing is something that's beneath or beyond or in back of what we see. So I can't tell you where grace is in these paintings. I find Munch is remarkable in his silence. And that silence is deafening. Yet there exists this painting in the world. It comes out of his body of work with no real precedent and no real reason. Why amidst the suffering that he experienced before and after would a painting like this exist? For what reason? How could we explain it? And let me suggest to you that the remarkable practice of art in general, and in particular, in this case, painting, is itself embodies hope. Have you ever thought about, there are artists in the room, have you ever thought about what it's like to devote yourself to a practice like painting? You get up in the morning and you want to do that, and then do it the next morning, and do it the next morning, and do it for the rest of your life. And to pour your life into a context, into a practice that is used to justify other people's lives. So that if you're lucky, when you're dead, a man who wants to justify himself will spend $120 million on a painting. What that testifies to is that there is something important about painting. We want to attach value to it. So the question of why do it? Why make a painting and make several paintings and then show them in an exhibition in which the people that come are coming to get some cheese and to get some wine? And entertainment after a tough day of work and going on to find their dinner plans. There's something remarkably futile and remarkably wonderful. And I can't tell you where grace is in modern painting, but I would suggest to you that it might be there if only you take time to hear and to be receptive. We have about 10 minutes left. So, questions? I hope I've given you enough, at least to be provocative, to allow you to think about some things. But please, give me some questions or something. Oh, and also, follow me on Twitter if you'd like, and I blog once a week at Pathios, in which I work out a lot of this stuff in public. I do my thinking in front of you all, so please follow me. There are a number of paintings that use that subject, yeah.
Was that an indication of despair? In other words, some of the ancient paintings, some of the other writers?
Perhaps, but what modern art, one of the things that modern art is very much interested in doing is not to picture or to provide an image of something that we already know something about. So, for example, Jackson Pollock was asked, you know, the abstract expressionist painter Jackson Pollock, who dripped paint on canvases, he was asked, does he paint nature? And his response is, I am nature. His context is, and I think it's instructive, you go to a painting and you see a painting of the Catskills or you see a painting of the Grand Canyon, and what impacts you about that is that you've already experienced the Grand Canyon. And his desire, and the desire of other artists in the modern tradition, was to make a painting that was its own experience. That didn't take you to the time you went to the Grand Canyon or to the Hudson River or some other place, but confronted you and created that experience. And so can you make a painting? Can you make a painting that does all of that without making reference to other texts, to other experience, in which you are discovering something new about the world? And it seems to me that when we are looking for grace, as a theologian of culture and as an art critic who's interested in looking for the operation of grace, the only place you can find grace is the brokenness and the weakness and the darkness and the death. Not in the depictions of heroes to emulate, but in places of brokenness and failure. Any other questions? RJ? Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the danger, one of the dangers as an art critic is to, and one of the challenges that an art critic has is to use language to interpret and explain what cannot be experienced. And the danger of always saying too much, of over-narrating. And we as Christians want to do that. We want to see God operating, and we want to know what God is doing. And so my God killing my career as an art historian, as a museum curator, killing my relationship with the artist. I didn't mention that. We haven't spoken. My best friend. God killed my idol. I didn't realize. I'm still in the process of working out my realization that everything I did, everything I wrote, was for his approval. And when I became inconvenient, when it became hard, I was discarded. But I was also discarded because I was his idol also. And that danger of saying too much, of over-narrating and finding grace. So how can you experience something gracefully as an artifact of grace in the world without it having to declare it so or without interpreting it as such? And that aspect, as R.J. said, I think, of being there. And that's what is so frustrating. In many ways, the difficulties of operating. And one of the other aspects that I'm looking at is at a certain point in the Western pictorial tradition, it becomes an aesthetic theology of glory. God is doing great things with great, powerful people. Modern art presents something, despite the particular religious faith convictions of those artists. It's a theology. Wherever the theology of the cross is, it's there, in that sense. That there's weakness. And it's a recognition of that, of the weakness. And my purpose in my talk is not really to convert you to becoming fans of modern art. It's just, here's a report from the wilderness out there. Some of you are interested in art. Some of you are really interested in art. That's great. Some of you are not. But if grace operates, is out there, it's even in this highly reified, strange community of artists for which Matisse and Munch are living and active figures. They wouldn't. The theological interpretation of it would make them very nervous, obviously, but there's a recognition of grace. Something is happening in which they become passive, and that's another aspect of it. The artist that I worked with, he would say, we talked about it often, that at a certain point the painting itself then begins to look back. We see that the artist does something, they express, and that painting is them going out in the world. But as the painter is painting, that painting begins to turn back and look at the painter and confront the painter. And he had told me there are numerous occasions in which, in the process of making a painting, in which it looks back at him and it is actually doing something, that he has to be passive. And that it begins to finish itself in some way. It's going in a particular direction that he has to allow it to go. And this is a scientist. This isn't, you know, an overly emotional, expressive guy. This is a stoic human who was trained in quantum mechanics at Cornell and Berkeley, saying, I have, at a certain point, this painting is taking me in a direction that I have to allow it to. That's grace. He's not going to name it and have that theological apparatus, but there's that sense that it comes to you, and the posture is a passive posture, and he senses that aspect that he is justified by faith. He senses that, and that painting is present as that. Okay.
If you would like a repeat performance, you can stay here. There's Beach Boys is downstairs, Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps and Grace Addiction is in Mead Hall. And
Sons and Daughters
is downstairs. And those of you who are only here for one session, you're free of charge. You can stay for another one if you'd like.
I didn't want to ask my question.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
My session?
The next session starts right now.
It starts basically in 5 minutes.
I'm not talking about these people who've already been proclaimed.
Hey, hey. Hey, Don.